Welcome to Iteration, a podcast about programming, development, and design. My name is JP. I'm a software engineer at Opendoor, and today I am joined, as always, by John. John, how's it going?
Hey, it's going awesome. Hey, my name is John. I build and maintain web apps for startups, and it's going really good, actually. I have some big news. Can I just steal the intro of the show here and give my big news?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Yeah, so I actually took on a jobby job, believe it or not, after 5 years of freelancing. I am on full time for a company called Main Street out of New York. That happened on Valentine's Day. It was like the official start date. It's been a long transition and like building that relationship and figuring that all out. But I joined as well as the majority of my software development agency joined. So we were working so much with them and so closely that it ended up we just ended up joining the team full time. And I couldn't be more excited about it. We're about 2 weeks in now, give or take. I don't know when you'll be listening to this in real time, probably almost over a month in. But I'm excited about that. And hopefully there'll be a lot more updates and examples from that new role. It's been great so far.
I love that. Also, I love that I've stolen this term from you, jobby job. Is that something you made up? Or like, what is that? I love referring to like working at a company versus like consulting as a jobby job.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from. It's just happened as a freelancer over time that like I needed to distinguish myself between what I do versus like a quote real job unquote. And so I call it a jobby job, you know, a job where you like have a payroll and have healthcare and have your taxes taken out versus like being a consultant or an engineer, which is what I've been for so long. So yeah, it feels very different. Not being a consultant and not kind of being that free agent. I'm still working remote, still working with a lot of the team that I had before. So there's like a lot of that's very similar to what I was doing before. But it's incredible already to just go deep on one project versus being scattered through so many projects and just being feeling really diluted. And so that and the vision of what Main Street does, which I'm sure I'll talk about more in the future, is just in such perfect alignment with my background and skill sets. It's just really exciting. So that said, let's get into the content for this week. I'm sure we'll talk more about my role in the future and new job stuff. So what we are reviewing this week is something called Developer Roadmap 2020. JP stumbled on this. I think it was a pick a year ago when it was the 2019 roadmap. And I've been wanting to talk about it ever since I found this. Well, JP showed it to me. You can find this at roadmap.sh. But if you just Google that term or web search that term, you will find this GitHub repo that is the set of charts that demonstrates the paths you can take and the technologies that you would want to adopt in order to become a backend, frontend, or DevOps developer in 2020. So basically like looking at this thing, I know that it's audio. It's this chart that looks like an insane person's conspiracy theory map. It's hundreds of nodes and each little bubble of nodes, they represent like hundreds of hours of learning in their own specialty altogether. So like just an example of like one of these bubbles, you know, one of these bubbles will be like JavaScript or HTML or CSS preprocessors. And so it is this giant web of bubbles that all interconnect and form this roadmap or path to every single skill you could possibly need to be a backend, frontend, or DevOps developer. So we're looking at this chart for kind of two main reasons. It's really just interesting, but here's the main two reasons we're looking at it. Number one, if you're new to development, it helps you make sense of all of the resources, frameworks, and languages out there. The roadmap covers like everything there is to learn. So that's the first thing. And second, if you're experienced, like JP and I, we've been in this a while, you know, we are quote unquote expert developers. If you're experienced, it really helps you identify gaps in your knowledge. So you can really quickly like look at this chart and see like, ooh, this whole wing of bubbles, I haven't touched this stuff enough and I don't know of it. And it even just helped me organize all this stuff in my own brain to understand like what the difference is, even just looking at the DevOps stuff, and we'll get into some of this stuff, but learning like the difference between a container configuration management and container orchestration and infrastructure provisioning. Like these are terms that I knew, like a term like Docker versus Kubernetes, but putting these in buckets in my own brain is actually really useful to go through this thing to kind of understand all these concepts. So yeah, any other thoughts at a high level of this chart? You're the one who first showed it to me, JP. How'd you find it? Do you remember?
I think it was like on a Reddit thread or on a tweet or something. I want to say I found it on Reddit when it was... No, I did find it on Reddit. And I think it was this guy who basically said, hey, I'm making this you know, I get a lot of questions of like what it takes to be an engineer, like a front end engineer or back end engineer or full stack engineer. Yeah. So I decided to like lay out this path. Let me know, like, let me get your feedback. And at the time it was like, I want to say it was like already pretty comprehensive. And now I think it's like grown exponentially.
Yeah, it's insane.
But basically I found it on Reddit.
It's a giant open source project now.
And
okay, you found it on Reddit originally. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, dude, there's like almost 100,000 stars on this thing. This is crazy. Overall, my thoughts are like, I think if you want to like level up and you just kind of find yourself at like, you know, like, oh, I've been a Rails engineer for like two and a half years now. Like, how do I like continue growing? That's always a hard question to answer because, you know, it's like, do I just like read the docs again? Do I like really practice my SQL? I don't know where I start. Mm-hmm. I feel like if you took a look at this roadmap, you can be like, yeah, here's a gap that I have in my knowledge. I can just get better at that and fill those gaps and continue like progressing as an engineer, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the pitfalls, though, is if you're always just pursuing every single bubble here, like going deep in all of them, then you don't really go deep on anything. So I would avoid that. But I think it's really good at least to have a high level understanding of how they all connect. But one thing that I love about the format of this roadmap is it'll give, like, for example, in when you think about backend languages, it gives like six recommended backend languages that you could pursue. But it says like pick one. So even though it lists Java, JavaScript, Python, Ruby, PHP as backend languages, Rust and Go, it lists like eight or nine. It says like, look, just pick one. Here's the one I recommend, just pick one. So there is a certain degree that even though there's hundreds of different nodes on this chart, each one, you don't need to learn every single one of them. In reality, you can just learn kind of one or two in each of these main buckets, and you don't need to learn them all. So although I do think it's really good to always be seeing where you can improve and where the areas are, I think there's a lot of advantage in depth at the same time. Because the reality is any one of these nodes could be a career all on its own. There's lots of people who make a complete career of just being CSS experts, just being GraphQL experts. And that's a single node on this list. So I think that's something to keep in mind as well is, even though this is the roadmap to have a good comprehensive knowledge, you don't need a thorough understanding of everything on this list. And there's a lot of advantage in just going really deep in one of these nodes. Is nodes the right word? I feel like that's a weird thing to call it.
No, I think that's right. I think if we're talking about computer science-y crap, then yeah, these are like all nodes of a graph.
Of a graph. Yeah. All right. So overall, this graph is kind of split into three big parts here. It's front end, which for those of you new to the podcast, it's just that's everything the user sees. So the actual pixels on the screen is generally front end. Back end is everything the user doesn't see. So that's the servers, the things that power it, database stuff, things like that. And then there's DevOps, which is basically, I picture this as like the Titanic boiler room. It's the guys down in the belly of the beast, like keeping the engine running and filling it with coal. It's really the actual like metal of the server and making sure that there's uptime. I do want to call out that there is overlap in all three of these areas and a shared fundamental understanding of the internet and of software that is required to do all three of those jobs. So you're not going to be a successful backend engineer unless you have a fundamental understanding of front end, vice versa, DevOps all the way. Do you have any thoughts on that as far as the different paths there are and how they interconnect, JP?
Not so much. Do you kind of want to talk about what the prereqs for any path? Because the beginning of this infographic graph thing has like a list of prerequisites and requirements that I think are kind of interesting to talk through. I think this is where there's like a lot of overlap. I think the biggest piece of overlap in general is like having a solid understanding of Git and version control. And, you know, I think we even have an episode about going in depth into Git, which I think is like pretty important. But certainly it's like one of those things that you can learn as you go. I think one thing that I would keep in mind with looking at these paths from fresh eyes is that it's not something like I can only progress into the next node if I like master this one thing. It's kind of all just you can do like a breadth. You could do breadth before depth when you're first getting started, right? Because like if you get caught up in the minutia of like Git, but you don't know how to like connect a Rails backend to a front end, then it's like, well, then what's really the point of like being really good at squash merging. I don't, or like a rebasing. No, it's true.
Yeah, like the weird Git stuff that you never use. I think that's really important to call out, that you'll learn this stuff at a different depth over time. And when we talk about like these basics or prerequisites is a good way to do it, that's kind of what I was saying, that regardless of what path you take, front end, back end, DevOps, there's some fundamental stuff you need to understand and get, no pun intended. But there's a couple on this list that I don't know very well. I have just like a cursory knowledge of, but let's go through that list real quick. So it would be Git, so basic version control, basic terminal usage. I remember the first time like opening up that terminal, it's that flashing white cursor. I'm like, oh, this is like Matrix shit. What am I supposed to do here? But getting comfortable with the terminal, basic data structures and algorithms is obviously important. That's a big scary word for just if statements. GitHub and just managing Git in the cloud and interoperating with different people in GitHub. We had a whole episode on Git and GitHub. I'll link it in the show notes. This is one that I really only barely understand, which is licenses and understanding like what you can and can't use. There's like MIT and different licenses. Semantic versioning, which is like version 1.0, 1.1, breaking changes and how that works. SSH, HTTP, and APIs, so understanding the fundamentals, design patterns, and character encodings. But like we've said before, almost any one of those nodes could be a whole career in itself. There's people who make careers being Git experts and semantic versioning experts. Like this exists. So don't feel like you have to know it every detail. Like I could only tell you one license type here, maybe two, Creative Commons and MIT. And yeah,
that's the one everyone knows.
We're professional developers. Everybody knows those two. So as long as you know what these basic things are, and I would actually add to this list, like it went so deep as like HTTPS and the APIs. I think just understanding the basics of the internet, like how the internet functions and like where a web page comes from, where it loads, I think is an important prerequisite if you don't already know that, at least at a basic level before getting into stuff. Do you have any thoughts on the prerequisites here?
I just like don't really know why character encodings is in there. I don't know when I've ever had to do anything with that I couldn't just Google in 30 seconds and be done with it and just like move on with my day. But I guess it's like... Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like we're more and more moving away from like all the theory stuff, but I don't know. I guess it's like important to know like design patterns so that you can like recognize them.
Yeah.
You know, like when you should use service objects or the factory pattern, blah, blah, blah. But like, I don't know. I don't think that these are necessarily like prerequisites. Like you can certainly be productive in a front end job or a back end job, you know, while you're still learning these things. So I think it's mm-hmm. not necessarily like prerequisites so much to me in my head. It's more of like, these are the fundamentals that you should be constantly making sure that you improve. For example, because, you know, let's say you're going down the front end path, which is like insanely huge these days. You can maybe skate by with not really knowing how to do CSS grid, for example, but like,
mm-hmm, sure.
And do you need to continuously, you know, revisit that? Maybe not. You can probably get by really well for years without, you know, doing it like other ways. Whereas something like version control and Git and like being very productive in the terminal, that's definitely something you should be improving continuously. Like looking back to your fundamental things of things you should know, you know, like API design. In fact, I think that these prerequisites are just things that like you should progressively look intentionally to get better at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think more than having to know all these two, just know what they are as concepts. Like design patterns, for instance, it's okay that you don't know, you know, the exact way to use a specification pattern and implement that. But just know that this concept of design patterns exists and what that is. And even just like know one, like CRUD, understand what CRUD is. Like that is great if that's all you know to move forward. And same with like character encodings. Like, sure, you don't need to be able to transmutate every ASCII character into its respective emoji. But at the same time, you should know that every keystroke is represented by that hexadecimal code. Like, it's not even hexadecimal. See how much I know of it? But like, know that under the hood, it's not a string. Like an E is not an E. It's actually represented by a series of numbers. And that series of numbers at some point is represented by binary storage. But like my understanding goes less and less as the concepts get more and more fundamental. Like you were saying, like it to be a web developer, to be a web dev in 2020, the actual computer science-iness in terms of like memory allocation and like understanding things like binary or basic. Like, there's no need for that in your day-to-day job. Even like advanced algorithms, until you get into more scale and data science stuff, you don't need any of that to just like go make an app. So don't be intimidated by that or feel like you need to get hung up on it, but understand it in terms of, if you know, if you had, like, if you get hung up on something, you know what to Google for and you know what exists to be able to dig deeper into that concept. I think that's really why they're listing these as prerequisites. Like, know what these things are at a high level and then, okay, move on. Like, I know what it needs to happen to move forward. I think that totally counts on all these. But if I was to like pick a couple, I would say Git, GitHub, and probably HTTPS and APIs, like the basic wirings of the internet. Those would be my three. What would be your top three here?
I might throw in like basic terminal usage.
Yeah,
because that's true. I've worked with developers that rely on like Git Kraken. I don't know if you know what this tool is. It's basically just like a UI for Git. Ugh. And like, that's so funny. The developer I'm working with was used, I weaned him off of it, but we have like a pre-commit hook that will run prettier on your JavaScript every time you git commit. And I was like, how come every code review I'm doing, I like notice that like there's a missing semicolon, or like the prettier like isn't running the formatter, or like the formatter isn't running on the hook. And I found out that it was because he was using Git Kraken, which I think is a really cool tool to visualize like your branch, their branch, blah, blah, blah. But if you're using it as like a crutch because you're apprehensive about writing commands in the terminal, I think you should like wean yourself off of that crutch and become super comfortable. Because I remember the first time I SSH'd into like our servers at Open Listings, I was like, what the fuck is what's SSH'ing? Like, I don't even understand this like concept.
And sure,
I think if you're not like comfortable with that, it just becomes like something that you push off more and more. And you really can't escape the terminal if you're going to be a developer in 2020. Like, that's just inevitable.
100%. Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And I think that's a good point. It's like, sometimes these interfaces like Git Kraken and other ones, like, it's useful when you have like a really complex merge, or when you're first beginning to understanding what's going on and visualize it. But over time, there's a lot of value in getting to that terminal. So then let's talk about the actual paths and content of those paths. Now that we kind of walked through the prerequisites or fundamentals, if you will. So we've got these three paths: the front end, the back end, and DevOps. How do you know what you want to work on? Like, let's say you're just getting into this. JP, do you have any thoughts on how someone picks whether you want to do front end, back end, or DevOps?
You know, I think it all depends. It depends, TM. No, I'm kidding. But it really does, though, because like, what I think it's like, what do you want to build and like what interests you? And I just feel like a lot of web dev these days is really just geared towards the front end. Because like, that's what the job calls for, right? Because like, let's say you have a client or you're at your job and you need, and what like really is going to boost conversion is like this weird complex interaction that somehow highlights the product better, right? More often than not, it's like the backend's already built for that, unless you're like building a new feature completely from scratch. Yeah. I feel like a lot of the times there's where improvement can be made is by being really good at the front end and being good at like JavaScript, I guess. But I don't know. I don't know if I have any thoughts anymore about like how you should learn how to do web development, because the way I learned was actually back end first and then front end. But I feel like there's this pattern of like first learning HTML, then learning CSS, and then learning JavaScript and React. For some reason, I've interviewed candidates that like didn't really know any back end at all. Like, their concept of like what an API was just like a black box. It's literally just like a magic thing. Like, I hit this endpoint and like somehow it spits out some data back to me with no concept of like, how does that connect to a database and like what an ORM is and what like MVC architecture is. And I think that's because like in their journey, maybe backend is prioritized later, which is all very weird to me because I learned Ruby on Rails from like an MVC first perspective and then like tacking on the front end on top of it. But I guess it just like really depends on like what interests you the most. Like, do you want to build complex UIs, or do you want to like figure out how everything works underneath all of that? Then maybe start on the back end, for example. I don't know. That's a very good question. And this is like, looking at it is like, if I had shown this to myself back in like 2015 or whatever it was, I'd be very overwhelmed at like, holy shit, do I have to literally know all of this stuff to be a backend engineer? I don't know, man.
First, I think you fall into one of these more naturally. Like you tend to be more interested in hardware, so you end up in DevOps. You tend to be more interested in design generally, and you end up in front end, like design and user experience. But to some degree, it can be frustrating, depending on your organization, to be a front end developer if you're interested in design, because you're implementing design, but you actually rarely get a deep voice into design. That's more of like the designer's job. There are exceptions to that. There's organizations who hire designers who code, and there are exceptions there. But so I do think you fall into one of these front end, back end, or DevOps naturally. But if you're unsure in 2020, I would highly recommend you start with front end, only because that's where the most jobs are. And like the grumpy old man in me hates this, but the back end is very quickly being absorbed by serverless, GraphQL. Like back end teams are shrinking and relying heavily on server infrastructures and smaller server back end teams. And the front end teams are growing exponentially. That's a trend I'm seeing in the industry, because it's harder to replace complex interactions with kind of like plug and play infrastructure, where in a lot of ways, like almost every single database just needs a CRUD interface with a little bit of business logic on top. Like it's actually not that hard to create systems that scale and just like allow you to plug into them. GraphQL is a perfect example of that. Serverless, like you can actually create a whole React app on top of Google Cloud and never touch a backend database at all and make great applications. Like there's actually applications running at scale that run that way. So I think in 2020, if you're on the fence, I would pick front end. I hate saying that because I really love back end development and tying that to front end. I like being a full stack person, but I think on if you're on the fence, I would go front end. Do you have any thoughts on that, JP? Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Just very surprised to hear that from you. I guess unfortunately I would give the same advice to myself. Like if I was like, JP, if I'm talking to myself 4 years ago, I would say like, learn JavaScript, learn React. But it just kind of like hurts me to my core because I really love backend development more. But given the like circumstances and context of like what's required of me at my job, I think I write maybe like 60% front end code, 65% front end code, 35% backend code. Mm-hmm. But oh man, like for me, I find more joy and just like really writing some really clean backend code with a nice service object, a really slim controller that just like you return some JSON data and has like, you know, some really efficient active record query that like took me, you know, minutes of benchmarking to figure out is like the best way to do it. Like to me, that like scratches that itch of like, I want to problem solve more so than like writing a fucking drag and drop in React or something like that. Like to me, front end is, unfortunately, it feels tedious to me at times, even though it's so tedious.
That's the perfect word, tedious.
It's like, cool, I came up with this really cool UI thing that is like, to me, if I showed some of the UI that I've built to myself, if I showed that to myself 4 years ago, I'd be like, that's insane. Like, where do you even begin to build that? Because that feels a lot more magical than writing some backend code, for example. But getting to that end is just, for me, not as satisfying as like figuring out how to hook up WebSockets to WebRTC, for example. To me, that feels more fun, even though it's like, I don't know. I think they're equally hard. I mean, there's like a lot of Twitter back and forth about front end engineering is real engineering. And it's like, yeah, I agree with that. I think those are like stupid conversations, but I personally find more joy in back end code. But like if I was starting out fresh with nothing, it's like, yeah, you kind of got to learn JavaScript. And what I think is interesting about the back end roadmap for this is that he has like recommendations, alternative opinions, and like things he wouldn't recommend. But his recommendation for backend language is actually JavaScript, which I found very interesting. And I wonder if that's because, you know, if you learn JavaScript, you can just write front-end code and you can just write backend code, which I don't necessarily agree with JavaScript being the choice of language. But historically, you and I have both just sang praises about Ruby, and that's probably why. But yeah, that's my like long-winded rant of like if what I would suggest, unfortunately, is front end.
Yeah, I think that we're on the same page there. And it's like I'm trying to just be objective about what the landscape is in 2020 from a career standpoint, like the jobs out there. There's just tons of React work out there and just JavaScript in general. And I think the trend is the black hole of JavaScript continuing to absorb more of the front end and back end. And learning JavaScript is that's the language to learn in 2020. I love Ruby. You should go learn Ruby as well. Like, go do Rails development. I will push all day on that. But to be objective, it's JavaScript. That's the one language to rule them all right now. Well, that said, that's been a lot of good conversation about these different paths of front end, back end, DevOps, and just all the shit there is to learn in the world. But let's actually get into the content of these charts. So let's kick this off with front end roadmap. So this is all of the different bubbles and nodes to be the front end person. Talk us through this a little bit, JP. What's on here? I'm just looking at hundreds of little yellow boxes.
Okay, yeah. So the funny thing is, the first thing on here is like internet. And it's like, what? But like, what is the internet, right? Like, how does the internet work? I think it's like a classic Google interview question. Like, if when I type something in the Google search bar and hit enter, like, what happens? And honestly, if that was to be asked of me today, I would totally fail. Because like, I don't fucking know. Something about sending packets of information back and forth and servers and yada, 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 stuff like that. That would probably be verbatim my exact answer to that. Which is maybe not something I should say publicly, but honestly, it's the truth. And just goes to show that, you know, maybe you can skate by and survive and even thrive not knowing exactly how that works. But that's like the top thing. And then like, obviously you go down from there to like HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. I think those really are the three core things that you need to know. And like, let's say that's all you knew. I honestly think that would be like fine to get you
by really far.
Like if you just knew vanilla JavaScript and took West Boss's like 30-day JavaScript challenge and just document query selector everything, and was like really good at CSS, you could honestly build really crazy, insane front ends that are like highly interactive. If you have a core fundamental understanding of that, I think that gets you very far. But then like, interestingly enough, as we traverse this graph downwards, because it's top to bottom, you get into things like we talked about, like GitHub and version control, which is all very interesting. But like, if you wanted to go, let me just digress for example for a bit. Like some of the things that are examples of things you should know in CSS, for example, are like, how does positioning work? How do floats work? How does like flexbox work? Those are the like personal recommendations that you should know. And I think that's true. I think it's all kind of things that you could just learn as you go. Like, you don't really need to know how CSS grid works as like a prerequisite for moving on to like the next thing, for example. But then after you get past those like basics, there's things like web security knowledge. And to me, I think that's interesting because I have huge gaps in that. I know there's this like OWASP challenge that you can like take where you basically have to like hack a website and like use SQL injection and all this crazy stuff that is like all so beyond me. Like, web security knowledge, I have like none. Like, for all I know, the sites I could be building are you can just hack the shit out of them. I use strong params in my Rails apps, and you know, I like whitelist parameters, but like, dude, I have no idea why something like an HTTP site that doesn't have SSL could potentially be hacked.
Sure.
And, well, I know that it's because it's like not encrypted, or, you know, like you don't want to be putting in like sensitive information that's not encrypted, blah, blah, blah. But do I really know how that works? Not really. What are your thoughts on like having deep knowledge of that stuff?
First of all, I love that this episode is just turning into JP and John admitting that they don't know a lot of shit, and yet they have great jobs and like are developers every day. So if you have, what is it, imposter syndrome, know that you're not the only one who feels like they don't know everything. Because I look at this chart and all the bubbles in the front end, back end, and I probably have like 30% that I can like confidently explain and like could write a blog post about. Maybe 30% of the bubbles I can confidently like write a blog post about. But when I get into DevOps and more of the backend stuff, it goes down from there. So I just think it's important to identify, like, we all have gaps in our knowledge, and that's totally fine. And again, like, understanding these things fundamentally and understanding where you have gaps so that you care, your team can fill them in and you can know where those gaps are. But I think I want to kind of address first thing here, this idea of HTML, CSS, JavaScript being the foundations. I could not overstate that more strongly. And I feel like a lot of these dev boot camps and code camps, they just introduce you to React in like month one, and you don't even fucking understand the JavaScript or HTML happening under the hood. I feel like it's kind of a problem, because you're so tied to the framework then that you don't have these fundamental understandings of how things are rendering out. And it's almost impossible to debug like JSX when you don't really understand the HTML and CSS and JavaScript being rendered at the end of the day. So I really, those three, like if you're thinking about what to learn, I would say in JavaScript in general, spend 70% of your time getting really good at just vanilla JavaScript, something that I'm still working on getting stronger in, and then 30% of your time on a specific framework. Because it's so important to understand what the basics are and how JavaScript, CSS, and HTML all work. And like I've worked with a lot of devs who they don't really understand JavaScript outside of Angular, or they don't really understand CSS outside of Bootstrap. And it's like, that's valuable, but not everything's written in Angular. Not everything's written in Bootstrap. So really understanding how these web pages render HTML, CSS, JavaScript is so important. But that said, like JavaScript for me, I look at some of this stuff like hoisting, event bubbling, scope, prototype, shadow DOM, strict. Like I know that stuff, but I couldn't write a blog post about hoisting and exactly how it works. But I understand enough to not get myself in trouble. But that's one of some of those areas where in terms of like CSS, like, yeah, I know all that stuff, floats, positioning. So your depth of knowledge is going to vary on some of this stuff. Yeah, so let's kind of keep going through there. We've walked through HTML, CSS, JavaScript, version control, web security. The next up thing here is package managers, which I think is debatable. I guess it's definitely a pain point if you don't understand it at all getting into projects. And then it kind of moves more down the front end chain. You want to keep walking us through it, JP?
Yeah. You know what's funny about package managers is going from like Ruby gems and just like running bundle install and having that global gem set just on my machine and then going to NPM totally broke my brain. I was like, what the fuck is node modules? Like, I just like, because it's just like, your gems, but if they were local and you can actually have it so that like it compiles locally in your project if you want to, it's just an extra command. But for some reason, oh my God, that first like month of NPM, I was just like, I don't get it. Like it broke my mental model completely.
Yeah.
Little side note. I just thought that's funny.
I'm still kind of there a little bit. I feel like I've gotten, for some reason, I feel like Bundler and RubyGems works and NPM just sucks. It just always has problems. I've gotten a lot better further in my career now, like not hating Yarn and NPM and being okay with it. But I still feel like I have a lot of dependency issues in front-end JavaScript frameworks that I don't ever get in Ruby. And I don't know if it's because the landscape changes more or what that is, but this is still kind of an area of pain for me a little bit.
I think I know why. Remember when we had our mobile app and we had a bunch of issues with Cross and his like version or his like dependencies and then like our dependencies.
He had this gulp script, this task runner and all the dependencies going on. Yeah, I remember.
So I think the reason that we were having all these like package issues is because we weren't locking our versions. And so he probably had different versions on his machine. And, you know, because packages update so frequently and the landscape changes so much, it could be that like he was on a different major version. So like if he was like on 1.x, but like I was on like 2.2.x, potentially that could just like really fuck things up. So the pro tip there is to like lock your versions and don't do all those.
Have a lock file.
Or like don't have like the tilde or like the greater than equals. Literally just have a version. So what I've started doing.
This is a really good tip because this has avoided a lot of pain for me. And you're exactly right. That's where a lot of my pain came from.
Exactly. Yeah. So like if you throw in like moment.js or whatever, don't put like greater than or equal to 1.2.3. Just put 1.2.3. And then you'll know for sure that across every machine that Git clones your repo, they will have 1.2.3 and it will just like
work.
Yeah, it will just work. And you won't have all these weird Yarn lock issues or NPM or like package JSON lock issues. But anyways, that is a long-winded
round. Let's keep going through.
Let's move
forward. So web security, package managers, and then we kind of move more into like, I would call this a lot of this stuff more like build tools or frameworks, like CSS architecture and preprocessors. Especially CSS preprocessors. So that's things like SAS and less post CSS. So this just makes it more efficient to write CSS and be able to use like JavaScript variables in CSS, vice versa, that kind of stuff. And then CSS architecture, BEM, that's the only one that I've heard of. There's on here OOCS, never heard of that one. But basically, these are just like semantic ways to use CSS that gets really powerful. And then we get into like build tools. So things like NPM scripts or gulps or module bundlers, which I wouldn't have called them this, but that's like Webpack and Rollup, which makes sense when you like put it in these bubbles. And then there's the whole world of linters and formatters. So I just want to like stop here for a second in build tools. Mm-hmm. Most of these are optional. Like even CSS preprocessors is totally optional. It just makes your life easier as you get more advanced in what you're doing. You'll find yourself reaching for these tools kind of as you need them. But on day one, there's no reason to have a linter on day one and like figure out prettier ESLint on day one. That's something that comes over time. But I think that's why there's dotted lines between these ones and not hard lines. Like the hard lines is what's required, like to move forward, where the dotted stuff is like, it's nice to have it if you've got it. And it's interesting to me that then finally he gets to frameworks, React, Angular, Vue, and everything within those frameworks. But it seems like that's far down the chain. Like a framework is above a CSS preprocessor below. That's, I don't know, it seems out of order to me a little bit.
Yeah, it gets to frameworks later on, which is actually kind of cool. I think I'm realizing... I'm realizing now that I think it's supposed to encompass literally everything. Mm. For whatever reason, magically, you could just like implant a bunch of knowledge in your brain and you implanted all of this, you would become like a fucking genius. You would become Mr. Robot and like be able to do literally anything. It's not to say that you need all of this. I think it's just like this encompasses everything, because I see on here like web components. Like, dude, I don't know what the fuck web components are. I've like heard of it on Twitter in the context of like CSS and stuff.
Sure.
But I have like no idea what that is. And then it gets to like CSS frameworks. Oh, we finally get to like Bootstrap and like Materialize and all that stuff. And it's actually not until very late into this graph that we finally get into like testing your apps, which I think is interesting. Yep. And then we finally, and okay, so I think this is where my like knowledge really stops of like most of these things, because for the most part, the top half of this graph, I'm like, you know, I've heard of most of these things. I have like some depth in some of these nodes. But then we start getting to like progressive web apps. And I think being good at progressive web apps is like a whole job itself. If you're like the PWA person, that could just be a thing itself. You know, you have things like server-side rendering with like React, and then you have like GraphQL, and then like static site generators. And like, I think a lot of the PWA movement is centered around like accessibility and internationalization and things like that, which all is very much beyond me. And like, how do you make a website feel like an app? I don't know. And then like, you have like GraphQL, which is interesting to me because I feel like that's very much a backend thing, but like not really. Because like GraphQL, like you have a GraphQL interface to query your backend, but like, I don't know.
I think that's what they mean by GraphQL in the context of front end is like understand how to interact with GraphQL, not how to build a GraphQL.
Got it.
And I think, too, as you get through this front end, a lot of this starts very general, like looking through the entire framework, trying to keep the context of all these bubbles and nodes. Looking through it, it starts very broad in general. Like it literally starts with the word internet. And then at the bottom, it gets very, very specific of like progressive web apps or type checkers. Like, so keep in mind that the value gets to be less broad and gets to be more and more specific as you go through this journey, which makes sense because you're going to get into more specialized like things. So for example, rendering out all of this front end work into a mobile application and deploying to the App Store via React Native, like that's its whole own thing that does live within front end. But again, like being a React Native expert is a whole career on its own without touching any of this stuff above it. But I think it's important to just understand where the core path is through. Like there's this blue line that defines this core path of those fundamentals moving through the build tools, moving through the CSS frameworks and all the way through. Yeah, I think that's, I mean, a good overview of everything that's here. I'd really encourage you to take a look at this overall. I think I'm ready to move into backend. What do you think, JP?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So backend here, it starts with the same thing, which is internet and then basic front end knowledge. It's interesting to me But what's weird to me is that the front end doesn't start with basic backend knowledge. And I think that is like an oversight on this. And I think that that should just be prerequisites of every single one. That like fundamentally, you should know the internet. You should know basic front end, basic backend, and basic DevOps. Like I feel like if you're doing any of these at a very, very high level, like be able to articulate a couple sentences, you should know the basics of every single layer, because otherwise you're just working in isolation and you don't really understand how it connects. But also say, so it starts off with internet. How does the internet work? What is HTTP? And then it starts with basic front end knowledge, So basic knowledge of CSS, JavaScript, and HTML. And I agree, if you want to be specialized in backend, like you don't need to understand floats in CSS at all, or even more advanced, like any of the more advanced HTML, JavaScript stuff, but you definitely need to have a fundamental knowledge of how you're getting data and how that renders out to users, because you'll never be able to debug if you're completely disconnected from what the front end is doing or how that happens. So it's interesting because the next thing it talks about is OS and general knowledge. So it lists a lot of stuff here that I don't feel like is essential, which is like process management, how operating systems work in general, threads and concurrency. I get that. I agree with the basic terminal stuff here. So like being really good in terminal and being able to manage processes in terminal and navigate your terminal well and deal with all of that. Then it goes into some other things that I think some degree is like just above my head. Like I have never, I'm a Ruby on Rails backend engineer. So that's very much like the lowest bar in terms of the technical requirements in terms of backend. Like I am not someone who does Rust or Go or, you know, C# backend programming. So I think that's probably why some of the stuff just goes over my head completely in terms of like inter-process communication and POSIX basics. I have no idea what that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But those are the fundamentals. And I think it's good to have some of those things. And a lot of these do make a lot of sense from a fundamental standpoint, terminal, threads, and concurrency. So then we get into learning a language. And I want to spend a moment here to talk through some of these different languages and why you could or could not pick them. The author recommends picking JavaScript. He just like puts this big purple check mark next to it. And he's like, use JavaScript for the backend. And I think there's a strong case to be made in the year 2020 to pick that one. I would also make a really strong case for Ruby just because the incredible community and the incredible like ease of getting into it. And then it's just incredibly powerful. There's lots of Rails jobs out there, lots of Ruby work out there for people picking up a backend language. But to call out a couple others that I think would be really great, PHP, I think it would be a great language to pick up. Go is another language. C#, if you're wanting to get into mobile application development, it makes a lot of sense if you're interested in gaming. Mobile application development, Java and C# might make a lot of sense for you to get into. Do you have any thoughts on these backend languages at all, JP? Neither of us are backend experts by any means, I don't think, beyond being Rails devs.
Yeah, I really feel like I would just recommend starting with Ruby on Rails because of its strong convention over configuration. Like if you just learn the convention and just start there, you'll at least have a really good idea of like design patterns and maybe how like, even though MVC is very tight and rigid and
model view controller kind of architecture in Rails. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, at least you'll be able to build off of like some fundamental design that people know about. Whereas like, let's say you start with just JavaScript on the back end. Dude, if you're just writing an express backend, that could be the wild, wild west. Like, because then what are your controllers? Like, you don't have like a concept where there are very specific lines of like, my controller just spits out the JSON. My model is does this. I have service objects that do everything in between. And then I have an ORM on top. I'm very guilty of writing express apps where the logic is conflated and it's like my controller is doing a billion different things. It's like making a query to the database, but it's also doing like a transform and it's also sending this. And I feel like it's because there's like no strong convention there and you could just kind of do whatever you want. Whereas like if you started off knowing Ruby on Rails as a framework, you might have like some point of reference of maybe this should be designed differently. Like maybe my controller should only be doing this. Maybe my model should only be doing this.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe that is a prerequisite, is like design patterns. And maybe that's why design patterns is like a prerequisite for everything, so that you don't just like jump in and write a bunch of JavaScript.
Throwing code everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. But I just really do like that Ruby on Rails, for me, set the stage for what my expectations of how an app should be written. It set those expectations very early on, and so that's like what I built off of, you know, because like once you have that, then you could start doing more research and doing more, you know, personal growth of like, how do I like make this better, how do I make this better for other developers who are onboarding and looking at this code. Certainly you can't just write like 100 line methods and throw that all into your controller. Like, will the app work? Potentially. Will it be tested? It might be tested, but your test might be twice as long as the code that you wrote, just because it's like the setup takes that much longer. Yeah, that's my rant about not picking JavaScript first, but hey, maybe it works for some people.
Yeah, and I think I want to throw in the caveat that people write beautiful and horrible code in every language and framework. There's examples of PHP out there that I would imagine are incredibly elegant and performant. And as a quick example, you know, I brought on a developer who primarily worked in Node and Angular, and then we started training him up on Rails because that's our primary tool. And he was just so receptive to it. Like, oh, like it puts everything in a place. Like there's a place for everything and everything in its place. And it provided so much like context for him to even just like reapply. So I think you're right that it gives you a really good rigorous structure, kind of like learning the rules to be able to break them in other frameworks. So I think Ruby is a really great starting point if you're just starting. But let's kind of keep going. So language is just the first stepping stone. Then it talks about databases, and there's literally 18 different database listed here. It's crazy. I think PostgreSQL, I never even know how to say this, but Postgres is probably the number one choice. MySQL is another huge one. Then it goes through more about databases in terms of backups and replication, APIs, into caching, again, web security knowledge, which I think is even more important on the back end than the front end. Then into testing, continuous integration, design and development practices. It keeps going from there. I don't want to get too far into like WebSockets and this other stuff, but I think we've covered a lot of good backend stuff. Do we want to move on to the DevOps thing here, even though neither of us are DevOps experts? Do you have any last backend thoughts?
Yes, I have one question for you. And that's Now that you've worked on like a couple of web apps that have in the scale of like tens of thousands of users, how challenging has it been using like Heroku and Postgres and like trying to scale a database up? Like, have you faced any of these challenges where you're like, yeah, I really needed to know about scaling horizontally? Or like, is it just like as easy as clicking a button and upgrading the dyno?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say I haven't reached any exponential scaling issues. I've definitely had growing pains on servers, but never had like 100x kind of volume overnight. I will say that it's generally as easy as sliding a slider on dynos. However, it's really expensive. So I'll give a quick example of that. Like we probably 5x the users we had on an application within 30 days. And our server bill went from like 150 a month to like 3000 a month. It was insane. And for like an early stage startup, that was so much money. And so yes, we were able to keep up. But then what's great is like within the next 30 days, we made performance changes so that that bill was down to like 800. So something that made more sense. So this was like things like killing background processes, putting things into background process, like so many different changes we made. But it was really painful and hard, but it's like actually responding to the influx was as easy as sliding the slider. But then we had to do the harder engineering work of refactoring things, paying back that technical debt to make the servers more efficient. And then like definitely we've reached into having to use, and I forgot the exact name of it, but instead of the integer type in Rails for IDs, you have to use the big O. Bigint. Yeah, we had to switch over to Bigint. So I did have that. And that was a really hard transition. So we had to do that like in flight. And I think the only reason it sparked for us is because Basecamp had this problem, like had huge downtime because of Bigint. And like, it made me look like, I was like, oh, we're running out of IDs. We should switch to Bigint. We're going to have the same problem. But overall, I would say that we have been able to just throw Heroku at most of our immediate problems. It's expensive financially, but doable and definitely staves off the need to do engineering. I think I answered your question.
It does, yeah. And I think that's like a nice segue into DevOps because you and I are Heroku engineers.
Yes, mostly, for sure. I have done a little bit of AWS stuff, spinning up my own server, enough to know it's something I don't want to do. But I've used Heroku and EngineYard heavily. And both of those are kind of hosted DevOps providers. So Heroku kind of does it with robots in the cloud, where EngineYard gives you a dedicated DevOps engineer in the cloud, which is really cool. And both approaches work really, really great. But basically, both of those provide you with virtualized servers running on top of AWS. And they have people in the boiler room, like I was saying before, like scooping the coal and keeping everything oiled and running so that you've got good machines to keep things running. And I love your DevOps roadmap note here, just basically say, learn Heroku, LOL. And that's pretty true. And I think that that's why this, if you're going to get into DevOps as a career, you need to know you kind of find this stuff fascinating and you want to go really deep on it because in the industry wide, these jobs are being eaten up by things like Heroku, by things like serverless functions. To a large degree, a lot of this DevOps stuff is being eaten up by automated processes and infrastructure. That doesn't mean there aren't tons of jobs. Like, obviously, go work for Heroku. Like, that's a huge DevOps job if you want it. But yeah, I think overall, this is one that I'm willing to just kind of like point out. It's here. It's interesting to look into. But since this isn't our specialty, it's like, eh, figure out Heroku. Go sign up with Engine Yard. If this isn't something that interests you, I'm great with that answer.
Yeah. And it's just like this sentence right here. I think this is like the main, the core of DevOps is like learn about managing servers. And then this mm-hmm. is the little blurb in the sentence. It's get some administration knowledge in some OS. Go with any Linux distro. Pick mm-hmm. Ubuntu if you have a little to no experience with Linux. And to me, that is just like, I imagine what when I describe my job to family members that are non-technical, that's what they hear. Because I like none of that. I don't know any of these words. I'm obviously exaggerating, but like to me, managing servers is just like that is so beyond me. And I do think it's like maybe at some point in my life I will want to do that.
Yeah.
But like for me to be immediately productive, it's just so much easier to just git push Heroku master. And now you can even just git push and have it automatically deploy when master gets merged. So
sure.
It's like such an invisible layer to me. Now, I'm certainly scared when, you know, something on Heroku happens that like I'm going to need to like go into the command line and like fix something or scale mm-hmm. up a dyno or I don't know, things like that. But overall, I just love that Heroku makes it so much less intimidating. And I think it's actually kind of funny that this whole thing is like sponsored by DigitalOcean and all we're doing is singing praises of Heroku. But I think they're like two slightly different tools. So
they are a little bit different. Yeah. So I do want to call out, though, in this whole DevOps roadmap in 5 years, and I've ran several production applications at reasonable scale, like definitely lots of thousands of users, so reasonable scale. I just want to call out a couple things that I have found valuable, even though I am very much a Heroku DevOps person. Like I am by no means a real DevOps person, but I've been the only person responsible for a lot of these servers, like the primary person responsible for keeping these things running. So a couple things I want to call out that are here. So there's this whole section of infrastructure monitoring. So that is making sure to like manage your uptime and have good logging associated with that. That will just help you sleep at night. So yes, figure out monitoring, get it in place, whether it's Datadog, AppSignal, whatever these things look like, to make sure that you have good uptime and that you can respond to incidents and like track incidents. Because otherwise it's just a black box and it's really stressful, like getting that text at midnight, like, hey, this isn't working, and not know what this is referring to. It's way nicer to have two texts. You know, the one from AppSignal telling you have an error or PagerDuty, and then the text of this isn't working, you know exactly what this is and how to address it. The other thing is logs management. I've had to do quite a bit of that for like audit purposes and like security purposes, like giving logs and logs access. And that's really useful to kind of understand what the logs are at a high level and how to secure them, how to make sure passwords and other sensitive information aren't getting dumped into logs. Some of those things are really helpful. I think understanding and picking a cloud provider is huge. So whether it's Heroku or Google Cloud or DigitalOcean or Engine Yard, and understanding that as its own tool. Continuous integration is another thing I want to call out. So that's things like Travis CI, Semaphore is the one I tend to reach for, but that's really, really powerful. That's kind of what you're describing of like, I merge to master and it deploys. That's continuous integration and having testing run on top of that. I do want to call out like networking, security, and protocols. So like emails, HTTPS, SSL, some of those things are really good to look into, and having some good working knowledges in those areas has really paid off really well for me. And that goes all the way up to like the DNS layer. Sometimes you'll end up with weird bugs with subdomains or things working on HTTPS, but not HTTP. And it's good to have a fundamental knowledge of that stuff. But in terms of like Kubernetes or Terraform, or like there's so much on here that I've never touched in 5 years of running lots of production applications, including I have never logged into, maybe once or twice logged into like a Linux shell in a server. I think once or twice I've done so in 5 years. So like, it's fine if you don't really understand Linux distros. Like I've run a Linux box myself. I've done it in the past, but like, you don't need to know it. If you are just running a small scale, if DevOps isn't something you're wanting to pursue as a career. So, okay, that's my rant over as far as DevOps and what I've learned and some things there that I found helpful.
Yeah. By the way, I love my text earlier to you, like this past week, frantically frustrated about like why my SSL cert isn't working. And it ended up just being that like it was still propagating. But I was just so frustrated because I don't think I've ever had to do that before myself. I've just like used tools like that just do it for me automatically. But like uploading an SSL cert and having it work on like the root and also www dot was like, why is it not working on whatever? And I remember this being a problem on WizTutor. And I was like, I'm following all the instructions on Heroku and DNS Simple or DN Simple. I don't know, DNS Simple. And it's just not working. And then I just like kept refreshing because I was like, maybe it's just not propagated yet. And then like after a while, like 15 minutes later, I'm like, oh, now it's working.
Yeah, DNS stuff is so shitty because it sometimes takes so long to propagate and it's so frustrating. Like, I didn't know that SSL cert, this is way, way back. This is 5 years ago with WizTutor. I didn't know SSL certificates like expired. And so we just had it expire in production. And then we were just completely down until I could get that renewed and then get that actually like uploaded and have it propagate out. I just remember like the founder being so frustrated, like, why isn't it fixed? Like the site's still down. And I just like was trying to explain this idea of propagation. It was so frustrating. But yeah, that was funny. You had like two texts like, oh, what's going on? And then like, oh, LOL, never mind. I was just impatient. I love it. So hopefully this roadmap conversation was really helpful. I would really encourage you to go check it out for yourself. Again, roadmap.sh, we'll list these out. We'll link it in the show notes. With that, let's wrap up with a couple quick picks. My first pick of the day is Cloud App. I think it's funny that I'm picking this because I feel like I get these from like a lot of boomers sending me links to screenshots. But the specific functionality of being able to grab a GIF as a screen recording, like for a specific UI interaction and then having it instantly upload, that's why I picked it. I've been doing that a lot lately and it's really, really useful. Because generally I've done looms, which is like the screen recording, but like sometimes that's too much. All I want to show is like this one dropdown and I need to show you that the dropdown's broken. And so I found it to be really useful in combination with Loom. So I've been using it a lot lately, just on the free tier of Cloud App.
Yeah, that's so funny. I was like, how are people getting these like arrows with white stroke and drop shadow? I'm getting so many of these. Like, are people just like applying a filter on the Mac preview? And then I found out about Cloud App and I was like, oh, that's really funny.
Yeah,
that's a good pick. Yeah, so my pick is this appointment API called OnSkedge, and I was just randomly looking at appointment APIs because, you know, whatever. And it's really cool because it lets you basically put like an appointment scheduler inside of your app, white labeled, that connects to your user's calendar. And I was just thinking how funny it would be if we knew about this or if this tool existed with WizTutor, because we could have just leveraged this and solved a lot of our problems.
So many problems around scheduling and availability. Such a pain in the ass.
Just like earlier on, this might have like helped us. And I think it's like a cool tool. I mean, it kind of gets like expensive after a while.
Yeah,
like,
this is thousands
of dollars a month. But I feel like if you have like a proof of concept that you want to like validate, certainly lean on this tool before you like go out and waste months of dev time building it out yourself. And it has like a really clean UI.
Yeah, it looks really nice. This is a great pick. I think it's interesting because if you listen to our last episode all about essential services and APIs, you'll hear a lot of the pros and cons of like building around a tool like this. But I think it's a great pick. So just to plug a previous episode. Well, thanks everyone so much for listening and we'll see you next episode.
Peace.